You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's show, we celebrate our local independent publishers and the authors whose work they publish. We did a similar show about 2 years ago when we welcomed four Portland-based indies to the KBOO studios: Tin House, Future Tense Books, Hawthorne Books, and Forest Avenue Press. While our studios have been closed during the pandemic and will remain closed for the time being until things clear up, the indie spirit persists. And that indie spirit is well represented by our guest today, Dan Armstrong, publisher at Eugene's Mud City Press, Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, founders of Portland's Pump Jack Press, and Bobby Eversman, editor-in-chief at Deep Overstock, a book publisher and literary journal also based in Portland. Instead of gathering in person in the studio, we're talking today via Zoom, which has been the virtual meeting place for many of us during the pandemic. Dan, Kathleen, Clark, and Bobby, I've interviewed you all individually at KBOO before. Dan, most recently for your novel Blake College, Kathleen and Clark for your Bonnie and Clyde trilogy of novels, and Bobby for your voice acting role in one of my favorite sci-fi podcasts, see Christopher Hart's Exoplanetary. I have to say how grateful I am to again hear your voices and see your faces, however virtual, during this very strange and tumultuous time. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Now, by way of introduction, I thought we'd start out with your origin stories just to give listeners a little background. Dan, let's start with you, since I think Mud City Press predates the founding of Pump Jack and Deep Overstock. And in the interest of full disclosure, you and I have been friends now for, I think, almost 40 years.
I think that's right.
And I'm only 36. So I don't know how that's possible. But in that time, you've always had a passion for writing and reading fiction and for the environment. And I know Mud City Press is representative of those values. Can you tell us why you decided to start your own press?
Well, I began in 2007, and I had published two books of my own, and they were novels, and they were environmentally, the backdrop was the environment. One was called Prairie Fire, and the other was called The Taming of the Dragon. And I had gone through many agents and publishers, and I had not been able to get them published. I became pretty frustrated. I thought the books were very readable, very entertaining. Of course, that's my opinion. But to get them out, I decided to begin self-publishing through a print-on-demand. And I decided also that the way that I would publicize myself was through a website, Mud City Press. I'd already spent quite a bit of my writing time doing essays on the environment. And so I used the essays on the environment as the bulk of what I called Mud City Press. I called it an electronic publishing and online magazine. So Mud City Press has many articles, several hundred by other writers, many by me. I have a compatriot that writes book reviews, and he has probably 80 book reviews on the website. But I began initially to use that format to advertise my own novels and to also establish my website as a format for discussing the environment. First year was pretty slow. I learned to make the website at Lane Community College. So my website is all handmade. It's almost entirely HTML, which you will never see again online. But my second year online, I became part of something called the Southern Willamette Valley Bean and Grain Project, which was an effort to get local farmers in the Willamette Valley to grow more dry beans and local grains. And that became a very successful movement, at least in terms of gaining attention. And my website went from just a few hundred hits a month to up to 20,000 hits a month, but I didn't sell too many books that way because most of my audience was focused on sustainability and they weren't consumers. So in any case, that's much the beginning of Mud City Press, Southern Willamette Valley Bean and Grain Project, and my own novels.
And we'll get into individual titles later, but just curious about the name Mud City. I looked it up. It's a nickname, one of many, for Eugene, where you live. It dates back to the arrival, apparently, of Eugene Skinner in the 1840s.
Right.
The town, I guess, initially got the somewhat pejorative name Skinner's Mud Hole, because it was a very muddy place at the time. Why did you pick that as the name for your press?
Well, two reasons. One, I played on a softball team called the Mud City Wranglers, and so that had something to do with it. And also what you said, the history down there by Skinner's Butte, it is muddy all the time. And there was also a sense with Mud City, a little bit of lightheartedness and a little sense of maybe muckraking. So that's where I got it.
Kathleen and Clark, you've published three series of novels through Pumpjack Press, starting with the Cowboy and the Vampire collection, which includes four novels in a genre you call the Gothic Western. The first book in the collection, A Very Unusual Romance, came out in 1999 through another house, so it predates Pumpjack. How'd you go from that first edition to the founding of your own press?
We were lucky enough to be published by, I guess what people would call a traditional publisher early on, Llewellyn Press. So we got to experience sort of the landscape of publishing before it started to change dramatically. And as it changed and, you know, we were able to access more tools, we started thinking maybe we'd like to be more in control of our own work, in essence. Our book was republished by an imprint of Llewellyn, Midnight Inc., and we're very grateful for that experience. Let me just be clear with that 100%. But after that, they opted to give us our rights back. And we took the rights back and we used that impetus then to write and publish, create our own press and write and publish three more books in that series.
Now, we asked Dan about the name Mud City Press, so it's only fair to ask why you called your press Pumpjack.
Well, it's really just harkens back to our own personal history. Clark is the son of a man named Hubert, who was a legendary wildcat oil driller in Texas. Actually, he went around the world. He drilled the first well in the North Sea. I actually started out my professional career as a geologist. And so between the two of us, as we were just kind of fishing around for names, one day I think we happened to be driving in some place where we saw a Pumpjack well and thought, you know, that's something that it's a word we like the way it sounds. And it had resonance and meaning for both of us. Now, I just want to be clear that that doesn't mean any affinity for the fossil fuel industry.
I know you both are very environmentally conscious, and that comes through in the fiction, certainly. Now, Bobby, you're the editor-in-chief for Deep Overstock for the Journal, and you've published some of your own short fiction over several issues. Can you tell us how the Journal started and how that also became a publishing house for books?
Yeah, basically Deep Overstock started when all of us at Powell's realized that everyone at Powell's is writing something, but a lot of people won't admit it at first until you prod them and prod them. Everyone there is basically an author. So a few friends and I decided we wanted to get some of these pieces published and push people to finish them. So Deep Overstock is a bookseller joke, which now, you know, hindsight, I realize it just sounds like porn, but it's a bookseller joke. Yeah, which makes sense to us, because when you have too many copies of a certain book, say Harry Potter, you have to put it in overstock above the shelf. And then when you have way too many, it goes to deep overstock. But that also pertains to books that just don't sell. Anyway, so the idea is getting the books out of people's heads or out of the attic and onto the shelf, because all the booksellers, they're shelving others' books while thinking of their own books that whole time. So that was the goal. We started that maybe 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, and it was just three of us. And one of the editors has since moved on to create his own press, Dorsa Brevia Press, that's Piers Rippey. And then the other main editor and I, that's Mickey Collins and me, we've been running it. And since then, we've got some editors who've just really made it happen. It was kind of happening, and then once we got Ariel Cuspy and ZB Wagman on board, they made the dream come true.
And so, in addition to editing the journal, the Deep Overstock Journal, you're also an editor of several of the actual titles, the separate books that you publish, and you're a professional editor. How did that come about, going from the journal to the books? You're just kind of expanding there, which is great to see.
Yeah, we got really lucky with the book. So the journal has been really fun. And after a few issues, we kept going. We're still going now. But we got really lucky to work with a writer in Portland named Andy Anderson, who's an excellent, excellent writer. And I worked with him to create their first chapbook. And the first poetry book we ever made was by Byron E. Blaze. And, you know, deaths are bad and everyone will eventually die, but there's some that just really hurt. And Byron E. passed way too early, but we published their poems and the collection is amazing. So that was our first book. And we're very proud of that book. And the second book was by Mark Savage. And Mark Savage is brilliant. He runs Mind Meld with Mark, which is an experience like no other. And then this book that he came up with is a collection of film reviews called Fictional Film Club about fictional movies that he's always wanted to make. And they're reviews of these movies. So we got really lucky to publish that. Since then, we've published the genius Jason Squamata, the other genius Coleman Stevenson. And then this month, we're publishing the absolute genius Jonathan Van Bell. That book will be really exciting.
Yeah, what a great lineup of Portland-based writers. Now, I mentioned in the intro that we had Portland's Tin House on the show in 2018, and that was represented by Holly MacArthur, an editor there. The journal which they put out, which dates back to 1999, stopped publication shortly after that time. I just hope that her appearance on my show had nothing to do with that. But happily, Tin House is still very alive, publishing books and organizing writing workshops. I wondered if that was a model for you at Deep Overstock, releasing both your own books and a journal that comes out pretty regularly.
Yeah, we could only hope to be anything like near the ground the Tin House walks on. But we definitely love Tin House. And the way that we structured it is modeled on Powell's, on the building itself. And we just kind of got lucky with publishing the books. But the way that we do the journal is in a way based on Tin House, but also based on the different rooms at Powell's. So we go through the full set of 9 rooms. Each journal will be a particular color based on one of the rooms, a particular department category. But yeah, the books was just pure luck. So we were very happy to keep going with the books.
And continue with the Powell's connection, your colleague Kevin Samsel there was also on the show with Holly, and he's the publisher of Future Tense Books. That goes way back to 1990. I think he started it in Spokane, Washington, before he came to Powell's. And he also manages the small press section of Powell's. Was Kevin and Future Tense an influence?
Yeah, honestly, Kevin is the only reason Deep Overstock exists. We were very lucky to work with Kevin at Powell's. And then Mickey and I just approached him one day and we said, we want to start something. How do we do that? And Kevin actually spent time, hung out with us, told us different avenues to go through, told us how to get the books printed, and then ultimately agreed to sell the books. So Deep Overstock would be nothing without Kevin.
Now, as editor-in-chief of the journal, the Deep Overstock Journal, how do you decide on the themes for each issue and select the work? Is that based on that Powell's, the different colors of the rooms?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the most fun things because me as a writer, I get really locked into doing one style. But for Deep Overstock, because we're quarterly, we go basically, it takes about 2 years to go all the way through Powell's. So we go from the Pearl Room to, I think, down to the Rose Room. We go back up to the Orange Room, and we choose the department category within one of those rooms each time. So this time for Pearl, we did Origin of Life. And we kind of vote on different department categories, and things are always changing within Powell's. So we have to keep up with Powell's, but we can kind of plan a little bit ahead. So now we're doing the gold room right now, mystery.
Yeah, I have a few copies here. I have Structures and Westerns, which I think might interest Kathleen and Clark.
Yes.
the Western ones. Now, Dan, in addition to your own work, which we'll get into, Mud City Press also publishes the work of other writers, both in your online magazine and as books. How do you select the authors, and can you give us a few examples? I know on the website, a book that's available now through Mud City is called Botanical Treasures by Joshua Smith, a nonfiction book.
That was the first book that I published that wasn't by myself. Joshua is a friend of mine. The story is a little long. I'll try to briefly tell it, but I had known him quite a while. We worked on a model of a sustainability model for the Lane County Fairgrounds that we gave to the county, but was never accepted. Joshua and I and three other individuals. But I had learned that Joshua was a very brilliant permaculturist. And I knew also that he wrote plant profiles all the time, but he wrote them by hand, all in capital letters. And he's was computer, not literate on a computer. I one day asked him, you know, Joshua, I really admire your work. I think it's very excellent work. What if you picked out your 20 favorite plant profiles and we published them as a book, which he had already had a title, which was Botanical Treasures. It's one of my favorite books that we've done. It's more of a reference book. It's extremely detailed. It's not limited to native plants, but it is really an ecological profiles. In other words, each plant, it is described visually what it looks like. It describes how you propagate it. It describes what products might be used from the plant, whether it be fibers or medicinal uses or edible uses. So it's a kind of a sustainability handbook. And when you read all of the profiles together, it gives you an overview of what permaculture might be. That was the first book I did. The second two books I did were with, one is called, is a collection of poems called Traces on Tracks. And this is by Harry McCormick. He's basically one of the most famous organic farmers in Oregon. He's responsible for writing the guidelines for organic products today. Our Congressman DeFazio put it into a bill about midnight in 1989 so that it became part of federal law. But Harry runs a farm in Corvallis. I met him through the Grain and Bean and Grain Project. Very wonderful man, a total activist. Nothing he does is not activism. And he wanted to do his collection of poems. It's about 550 pages, hundreds of poems. He was a student at the Iowa School for Writing in the late 60s. He's older than I am.
Oh, is that available now?
That's available now, yes. And also he did another book called Grandma's Book of Healing. And it's the story of a medium who grew up in Idaho next to a native indigenous tribe and became a medium, ended up living in Corvallis and became famous, famous within the realm for being in touch with spirits. So Harry wrote her life story through astral projection. Very interesting process. He would visit her once a week. They would go on a trip through meditation, and he would relive portions of her life, which then he would go home. He would record them. Then he would go home and put them into writing. It's a very, very unusual book. A real mind bender, I guess is what I'd say. But Harry's really a great friend. So I've done two with him. And then I've also done another book with Deb Moore, who wrote a Western romance called Beyond the Land.
There were no vampires in that book.
No vampires, okay. But it's interesting. That's where she grew up, and she's 90 years old now. So the story is set basically just before her childhood in Eastern Oregon and tells the story of the Indian Wars that most of the Oregonians I know don't really know about, and the infamous march where the U.S. Army made, I don't know how many thousand Native Americans walk to a prison in the Tri-City area in the middle of the winter. So it tells portions of a very difficult story. But Deb did that novel for me, and I ran into her kind of by accident. She had read some of my books, asked if I would publish hers. Because she was such a nice lady, I just said yes without reading the book. I then
That could have really worked out badly for you, Dan. You got lucky with her.
I think a good heart pays itself back.
It does.
And when she gave me the manuscript, I proofread it and edited it, which took a little bit of work. But by the time I'd finished editing it, I thought it was a great book. And I said, well, how lucky. This is not only now edited, but it's a fun story, and I've had very good response to it. Deb is also a sort of a celebrity in Oregon. They recently renamed one of the halls D.D. Hall because he was a Ku Klux Klan member, and they renamed it for her husband, Uthank, who was a black man, and she is a white woman. And so they were a mixed couple in the early 60s and received a lot of intolerance. But just in the last, I think it was 3 years ago, the hall was renamed for her husband. So Deb is an extremely interesting woman, and she's written other books prior to the one that I did for her.
So I want to get next to the individual titles that you've written, and Clark and Kathleen also. Maybe start, Kathleen and Clark, with you guys. We've mentioned your first series, The Cowboy and the Vampire Collection, which includes four books. The Bonnie and Clyde trilogy, which we've talked about in previous interviews with you. The most recent series is the Halo trilogy. And the first book, Gates of Mars, came out last June. Book two, Scorched Earth, comes out next month on Valentine's Day, February 14th. I wonder if that was deliberate on your part. It sounds like it might be.
Yeah, I'll jump in. It was 100% deliberate. first of all, it's sort of our books are like a love child, so we thought that would be appropriate. But one of our characters' names is Valentine, so we thought that would be an interesting day to launch it. We'll see how it goes.
Can you talk a little bit about the trilogy, Clark or Kathleen, if you'd like? It's a bit of a leap for you. Previously, your fiction was more historical or placed in historical settings, and this takes place somewhere, in 2186 or whatever, on Mars and on a very environmentally devastated Earth.
So taking just one step back, Ken, from your question, it is definitely a departure for us. As you said, the first one is Gothic Western, the second is alt history. But consistent throughout all of our titles at Pump Jack Press has been this commitment and this just passion for economic and social justice issues, and to share our views, frankly, on how to be better at that through really entertaining genre fiction. So not in a didactic or a lecture-y kind of way. And so the Halo trilogy, as do the other two series, does that as well. And so what it is basically is, think about all the headlines you see right now about Elon Musk and other plutocrats, frankly, who are trying so hard now to get to Mars. And so what we've done is we've taken that core of an idea and we've extrapolated and projected it out 150 years. And let's say, okay, they did it. And the government wasn't involved. It continued to be sort of in a private enterprise kind of way. So they get to Mars, and all of the other things that are going on in the world right now on Earth just keep going along. And they don't really change that much. As one of our reviewers on the East Oregonian said, imagine that if everything that went wrong between now and 2187 actually goes wrong. And so that's the setting. And so we impose on that a hard-boiled detective story. And it's basically a missing person's story from our irreverent anti-hero, which is sort of like Clyde in Bonnie and Clyde, and sort of like Tucker, our cowboy, in The Cowboy and Vampire. I mean, they're very different people, but they have this kind of irreverent approach to the world, which is frankly pretty funny. And honestly, it's based a little bit on Clark.
I was wondering if I should ask that, if they were all kind of based on this one real life character, your husband.
I would be flattered if that was the case, but I think it's more realistic to say that they are cynical like I am, but they are far funnier than I am. And I would say that our hero in the Gates of Mars trilogy, Crucial Larson, is sort of like a mix between Mike Hammer and Flash Gordon.
And I know your Bonnie and Clyde had been compared to Nick and Nora Charles of the Thin Man series, Dashiell Hammett's books.
Which was a very great comparison, which we were very happy for. High praise.
Now, all of Pump Jack's books have been part of a multi-volume series. I was wondering, are there artistic reasons, maybe even commercial ones, for publishing a series rather than a standalone novel? I mean, I'm thinking of the Harry Potter books, which Bobby mentioned previously when we talked about Overstock, The Lord of the Rings. There's several other really good examples.
So I think that really it's both editorial and commercial reasons. I think that we enjoy writing in a series and enjoy writing at that length and with that larger narrative arc. But also because if you have a reader who's really interested in what you're reading and they want more, we'd like to be able to give them more. So that's, I think, how we've made that decision. Now, we do have some titles that will be forthcoming next year, or maybe we hope later this year in 2021, that will be single standalone titles. And we're also, now that we've published up to it, we're at 11 titles, I think, total. We're definitely interested now in seeking out partnership opportunities with other authors. We'd like to expand and share the expertise that we've gained in the last decade and to be part of what we see as a shift in the ecosystem of publishing away from sort of more corporate royalty-based models to something that is more like a collective and a partnership of authors working together. In many ways, what Bobby's described with Deep Overstock.
Now, Dan, I want to get to your books individually. You have a very impressive body of work and a diverse one. In addition to Blake College, which we talked about in a previous interview, that book, by the way, takes place in 1970s era Eugene, a time of great political turmoil. You've published the novels Chain of Souls, Prairie Fire, Puddle of Love, Taming the Dragon, Cornelia, The First Woman of Rome. And you also had a series, a trilogy, The Eyes of Archimedes, about the mathematician and his slave going back to Rome in 200 BC. And you also have a short story collection, The Open Secret and 12 Tales of the Unknown. How do you decide what to write? And given the diversity of the characters, the settings, the time periods, what do you see as common threads in your work? I know there's also a very strong environmental theme and political theme.
Well, let me just add one more book, The Jewel Case, recently published. It's a story
I was going to talk about that next. So
I'll just say the title. And then there's one that will be out in a month called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Man, you're all over the place.
You're
a Renaissance man.
I follow my nose or maybe my pen. So I will write about whatever is on my mind. If it doesn't interest me, I can't write it. And I also have discovered that I make most of my money, if we call it that in this case, I barely break even. Most of the books that I sell are face-to-face at book festivals. I sell maybe 100 online during the year, but I sell more face-to-face. And I discovered that if you're at a book festival and someone comes and look at your wares and you have four or five historical novels, but nothing else, they look, and if it's not their niche, they move on. So I began to write about as many different things as I could find interesting so that if someone stopped by my table, I could say, well, if you don't like this, then you might like that, you know? And that has actually been a good idea. And adding Joshua's book on plants has been a nice addition, plus Harry McCormick's poetry and Deb Moore's Western romance. So I have diversified the stories because I think that's me, but I also discovered that it helped me sell more books.
Yeah, it's like having your own focus group when you're at the book fairs.
Well, it's like being a feedback. Bookstore. People say, what do you have as a mystery? I've got a couple of mysteries. Do you like historical novels? Do you have something that's funny? Do you have anything set in Eugene? Anything set in Oregon? And yes, the environment has played a big part in the first two novels that you mentioned, Prairie Fire, which is actually named for the document put out by the Weather Underground in the 70s, Prairie Fire. And I think by publishing that, I have permanently blacklisted myself. Now I'm 70 years old, or 71. And I will add one thing about my stable of writers. The average age of my other writers is 81. So at 71, I am the youngest person in this, won't call it a collective, but in this library of
Mud City Press.
You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're celebrating our local independent publishers with guest Dan Armstrong, publisher at Eugene's Mud City Press, Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, founders of Portland's Pump Jack Press, and Bobby Eversman, editor-in-chief at Deep Overstock, a book publisher and literary journal also based in Portland. I want to get to the latest novel, which you mentioned, The Jewel Case. This book takes place in turn-of-the-century Vienna. So I think the dates are right, 1894 through 1902, and it tells the story of Sigmund Freud and one of his patients, whose real name was Ida Bauer, but he refers to her as Dora in one of his published case studies, Dora, an analysis of a case of hysteria, which, to put it mildly, hasn't aged well. It was taken almost as gospel at the time, and that's no longer the case. Can you tell us how you came across Freud's book and what inspired you to use it as the focus of your novel? You mentioned that it has to interest you or you can't really write about it.
Well, as a novelist, I do explore various writers about psychology, psychiatry, the state of the human mind. It's very important to me in my writing. So I've read a lot of Sigmund Freud, though he is controversial in many, many ways. He's one of the most imaginative writers I know. He, regardless of what you think that he's written, he goes places and with great imagination and style that I've always loved. One of my wife's cousins is a psychoanalyst, a Freudian psychoanalyst, and I had dinner with him one night and we started talking about Sigmund Freud. He asked me if I'd read any of his case studies. There's several of them, three very famous ones. One is called Rat Man, a second one I'm not thinking of right now, but one is Dora, a case of a study analysis of hysteria. And I read that one first, and it's only about 140 pages, relatively short, and it blew me away. It was so interesting. Now, as Ken said, if you read it today, it feels like it was written in the Stone Age in terms of awareness for women, sexuality, and all of those things. But still, the piece is very interesting. And I read it the first time and just found it fascinating. But I thought to myself at the time, wouldn't this make a nice short novella? And I read it again. And when I read it again, I realized that I felt that Sigmund Freud had uncovered something that he did not point out. And that was that Dora had been, in my opinion, molested by her father. And that was where all of her problems originated. Freud doesn't write that. And it has been somewhat addressed in modern times by feminists who have criticized Freud. But what I tried to do is write Freud's Dora from the point of view of Dora, Ida Bauer in real life, and that's the name I use. I wrote it in the spirit of the Me Too movement. Because in a sense, Freud's book represents a true revelation of the state of men towards sexuality in women. This is 100 years ago. And it's surprising how long it's taken to change. And obviously any woman would know it's still changing. But in the book, Freud comes off rather barbaric. And Dora, Ida, comes across as a relatively intelligent woman who has been the victim of not only her father, in my understanding, as I interpret the analysis, but also of another man, a friend of her father's. Freud tells the story from the interaction between Dora, Ida, and this other man, and two incidents where he sexually approaches her in an unfitting way. And that's where most of the analysis happens. The book is about half analysis. I have taken apart all of Freud's 10 revealed sessions of analysis and rewritten them in a dramatic way, and runs in parallel with incidents that happen in Ida's real life. So I try to show her as a individual and then as an individual sparring with Sigmund Freud in essentially 10 sessions. I have had this read by my cousin, the psychoanalysis, and then a woman psychotherapist in Eugene, and then a friend of mine who taught Dora at the University of Oregon for 4 years. And all of them, they are friends, so maybe they're being kind, but all of them said that the sessions were easily the most gripping parts of the book, and that they thought that the way I interpreted it was very clarifying, even for them. So it's
high praise.
High praise. And I call it a psychoanalytic mystery. And it's relatively short. And I'd say one thing that people have said to me is it ends very abruptly. The book ends abruptly. And so do Freud's sessions with Dora. And that was my way of kind of slamming the door on this story. And that is one of my favorite books. And like I said, it's been out about a year.
Oh, Bobby, we've mentioned that you've published a short fiction in several issues of the Deep Overstock Journal. Do you have plans to publish any of your work as separate volumes through Deep Overstock, a novel, a book of short stories?
Probably not my work. I've kind of given up on the writing edge and doing more of the editing thing. I might pick it back up. You know, I do want to mention, though, Mud City Press and Pump Jack are just incredible. And every time Dan writes something, it's like he's just reading my diary. I want to read exactly what Dan is writing from Sanxia and Taming the Dragon to the Archimedes trilogy. So incredible press. And then also, like, regarding Pump Jack, what Kathleen and Clark can do, the reason I think that you can do these trilogies is that the characters are so strong, they can actually pull it off. It's as thrilling as Mike Hammer, but, you know, Mickey Spillane is like slightly despicable, but Kathleen and Clark are actually excellent people, so their books are much smarter than the Mike Hammer books while being as entertaining. I just started Gates of Mars to try and get prepped for Scorched Earth, so the style is just perfect. The style is so good.
We also mentioned in the intro that you've talked before at KABU with me when we did a show on Exoplanetary, Christopher's podcast. We should mention you have your own podcast through Deep Overstock, Late Night Poems Radio, a poem spelled P-O-M-E-S.
Yes, intentionally.
Okay. And you co-host along with your fellow editor-in-chief, Mickey Collins, who you mentioned. Can you tell us about the podcast and maybe the appeal of podcasting to you, maybe as a compliment to your writing and editing work and other things going on at Deep Overstock?
Definitely, yeah. The podcast has been a lot of fun. I've been out of the country for the last few years, and this is a project we've been working on for, I think, 6 years now, but we've only just renewed it as a podcast. But it's really how Deep Overstock started, was at Powell's. Some of us just wanted to hang out after work, go to the bar, but none of us could really talk well. We didn't know how to actually socialize. So we tried to figure something out, basically. And so basically, Jonathan Van Bell, Connor Miller, and I started this thing called Late Night Poems. And I don't pronounce things very well in general, so I just kept inviting people to, do you want to come write poems? And so people started coming to the bar, and it's basically a bar game where we give a theme and we make a game kind of on the spot, and then everyone has to write a poem. And there's usually three rounds. And what it did was it got us to kind of socialize, got us to write together, and turned writing into kind of a community practice, or kind of a more of a conversation. And at the end of the night, after too many beers, we would go underneath that really strange sculpture that's outside of Powell's.
We would shout poems
from there.
Yeah, right on Burnside. Oh, yeah.
Exactly, the one that you can move. So we would get it swinging, and then we would start reading the poems.
Yeah. And people,
and, you know, people would just walking down up and down the street.
Can they could find the podcast. We'll give the websites for all your work.
Oh, cool.
For all three presses towards the end. I'll make sure everybody knows where to access this. Now, the next part, I'd like to ask some kind of more general questions about publishing and open it up to all of you. Some of these I kind of stole from my interview with Kevin and Holly.
Oh, cool.
And Rhonda of Hawthorne Books, and also Forest Avenue Press. I think we included that for that show. As a publisher, you have to wear several hats. Writers, your editors, marketing, which doesn't come natural to a lot of us. Was it difficult to learn and take on each of these roles? And did you have any kind of resources and mentors you'd recommend? Well, of course, Bob, you mentioned Kevin as a mentor and quite a valuable resource.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Kevin is the whole reason it got off the ground. From every respect, he gave us advice on marketing, on working with editors. So he really got us going in that direction. As far as marketing, again, those two editors that joined in a few months after we started, Ariel Cuspe and ZB Wagman, Mickey and I kind of knew what we were doing, and then we brought them on and they really brought it to life. And ZB Wagman and a new editor, Mike Santiago, have been running our other podcast called the Deep Overstock Fiction Podcast, which is a complete ripoff of the New Yorker podcast. But we're trying to do things, we're marketing through new projects, which has not proved really all that effective. It's thrilling, it's fun for us, but we're trying to come up with the different media to, I guess, get people roped in to become interested in the books, become interested in doing this late night poems thing with us. So kind of like a connectivity model is our marketing scheme.
Clark, enjoy that. He's on mute right now, but let me get you guys back on mic, Clark and Kathleen. How do you go ahead and market? When you send me the books, they're just beautifully packaged. Like Gates of Mars came with several questions and answers to kind of give readers and reviewers a little bit of background before they even start the first page.
Sure, I'll jump in here. How do we approach marketing? With great dread and uncertainty and constant sort of self-flagellation. Kathleen and I both work in communications, so we have a real baseline understanding of sort of how to present content to people, but I will say that it's very hard, it's very challenging. You know, we've been doing this for a while, you pick up lots of things along the way, you make friends, you make a lot of mistakes, and you keep plugging away, and it's never easy. And I'm gonna go rogue here, and I know Kathleen's probably gonna punch me, but I'm like the Lloyd Dobler character in Say Anything, and I'm all grown up and cranky about it, but I don't want to write about writing to make money. I don't want to talk about writing to make money. I don't want to be a good marketer with my writing to make money. I just want to write. I feel like I have this towering ego, and I'm also super insecure. So it's perfect for writing. And Kathleen and I work very well together. We're a great partnership. I just want to write. So that being said, in the current landscape, when people really can't make money as writers anymore, you have to do this other stuff. And it's very painful. And every time I'm marketing or thinking about something for our website, or thinking I should be on Twitter, or thinking I should post something on Instagram, what I really want to do is write.
Although I want to point out something, Ken, you are the exception to that rule.
Oh, thank you.
I very much enjoy talking to you.
Oh, thanks. I didn't take offense at that.
I just want to jump back in for 1 second to make sure we're clear on that. I don't consider this marketing. Oh. I consider KBOO to be like just a bastion of our community. So don't even think about that. And it's so nice to meet people who are working so hard in this space. It's nice to, you know, to meet Bobby and Dan and to be able to talk about writing. Bobby, you're amazing. You do so much. I don't know where you
get the amazing.
And Dan, you know, your books just sound amazing. And I'm just going to say real quickly, your Freud's story made me think. I read this book of Eels recently. It's nonfiction. And there's a long section in it about how Freud's first scientific posting, if you will, was fruitlessly looking for eel gonads in a port city in Italy.
That's right. That's right. I know that story.
Oh, Dan, let me cover you too. Now, you mentioned book fairs as part of your marketing, so that's great. I mean, that's face-to-face directly with the people who are reading your books. Is there anything else that you would recommend that you've done that you maybe would just want to avoid and won't even attempt?
Well, I'm going to say I really relate to what Clark said. I really want to write. I am not a marketer. I hate to sit. I don't like to talk about myself so much, although a show like this allows me to. I'm not really a person to broadcast about myself, and I don't like telling people I'm great. So I'm not a good marketer. Before I go any further, though, I want to say thank you to Bobby for the shout out to Pump Jack Press and Mud City Press. That was much appreciated and very thoughtful. Thank you. But I really hate the marketing, and the distribution for me is a nightmare. However, I have tried some things. I have used Amazon advertising, where you can pay by the hit. it works. I can definitely create sales. I can, if you write novels, you can also, you, if you do Kindle Direct Publishing, you literally sell books by the page with, I imagine Clark does this. I don't know about Bobby. Do you have Kindles where you can see, they're in the free library and you can see how many pages of each people are reading and you get paid a half a cent a page? That's something I've done, but I never quite break even with it. I'm always about 90, I get 90% return on my investment. So it's not so great, but I like readers more than money. So it's a trade-off. You know, readers are really what I seek. Money is a long forgotten. I've run my press for 14 years. I started to break even 3 years ago, actually, and I'm talking about cash outlay was less than cash in, but not related, ended up about 50 cents an hour, maybe less. And then this year happened and it's been a disaster because there's no festivals. Other things I did when I wrote Prairie Fire, which is an international thriller about the grain market, I learned about the buying and selling of grain, writing the novel. And in the process, I met local farmers who were growing grains. That's when I became part of the Bean and Grain Project in Southern Willamette Valley. And it's a very, very interesting thing if you're an environmentalist to see what this project is about. It is still going on, but it was not as financially rewarding as we hoped as a part of a sustainable economy, but it is still a very smart economic environmental thing to do. But that was my greatest marketing effort because I became a speaker. I speak at the U of O, speak at Oregon State, I speak at LCC, and I have done public lectures to the city and to the county about the concept of broadening the agricultural base of the Willamette Valley. So that got me out. But again, it did help me sell books, but often my audience were environmentalists, sustainability freaks, and they're not big spenders like myself. So selling books to people that are pinching their pennies is like pulling teeth. So as a marketer, I'd say I've been a failure. And that I want is readers.
Kind of a necessary evil, I guess, for all of us. Now, before we close, I'd like to go around and ask each of you what's next for your press and your own work. Kathleen and Clark, I know book two of the Halo trilogy is due out February 14th, Valentine's Day. Book three, that will close the trilogy. Maybe talk a little bit about that. And then I think you mentioned that there might be some individual non-series titles on the way.
So, yeah, so we're working now on book three. It's called, what's it called?
It's tentatively called Mars Adrift.
Yes, Mars Adrift.
Okay.
And so we expect that will be out in 2021. I think this year we're going to be taking a good hard look at the press and trying to figure out a way that we can expand our focus so that we can partner with other authors on a more frequent basis. And then I have an individual title that's coming out that I'll just add a tiny little plug for, which is more in the realm of literary fiction. And it's about a young woman who has recurring near-death experiences without the specter of death. And so I expect that one will be out probably in the next half year or so. And then Clark and I will embark on our fourth series together.
And I should mention, listeners can find out more about your books, all your work, and purchase the books. And I think it's best to purchase it directly from you rather than through Amazon or even Powell's, Bobby, in terms of making the most return on it. And that website is pumpjackpress.com. And Dan, you have a new novel you mentioned that you're finishing up. Do you have a pub date for that?
I'm waiting for some artwork. And it could be a couple of weeks, but I anticipate publishing it the first week of February. It's called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. It is a fantasy based on a romantic poem written in the 1400s. It's a story of King Arthur. And if any of you have ever read Bradley's The Mists of Avalon, Very remarkable book. Not everybody likes it, but what it did was add the women to the story of King Arthur with deep, intricate, and very interesting characters. So the original Sir Gawain and the Green Knight was written without women characters also, although they are in the background, deep background. I've turned the poem into a novel where I've reintroduced the three main women as main characters. The Green Knight is a representation of nature. So Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is really a story about the moral interaction between civilization and the forest. It's a poem, it's done as a fantasy, it's not written in that kind of sense, but that is really the backdrop of this novella that I've finished and just got to publish.
And Dan's website, which is written entirely in HTML, is mudcitypress.com. And Bobby, what's next from Deep Overstock? And your website is deepoverstock.com.
Yeah, we're working on a few things. I definitely agree with Clark. Marketing is like pulling your own teeth and trying to smile the whole time. But I think Dan's idea is really great, like doing what you're good at, going and speaking and getting involved in environmentalism. So what we're trying to do is get more involved in literacy and trying to work with different organizations. Like Kate McPherson was running a literary journal through Roosevelt High School, getting high schoolers really thrilled about writing. So we're slowly trying to get into that. But the new book that's coming out is by Jonathan Van Bell, and it's so cool. It's a whole philosophical system that's laid out within the book. It's called Zenithism, but it's divided up between kind of like a dialogue, some travel journalism, short stories, and it's the idea that, well, it's really, I can't do it justice, but the first story opens up with a girl who has a dream. She's in ancient Egypt. She lives on the Nile, and she has a dream about our future technologies, and she tries to explain them to her father. And then, so the rest of the book is almost like Jonathan trying to come up with ways that, I guess, advancement will be more harmonious. So, you know, it deals with some predominating philosophies right now, like transhumanism, but it also looks at environmentalism. So yeah, it's a beautiful philosophical system, but it's also very thrilling to read.
Well, that's a really good way to close, because, I mean, that's a book that you're having trouble as the editor and the publisher explaining. I would imagine a big publisher would probably not even touch something like that. And yet this could be extremely valuable to readers out there. The kind of literature, if it wasn't for independent presses like all of yours, we wouldn't be seeing literature of that caliber, that nature. And I think readers all over the world have you guys to thank for that, and other independent presses. I want to thank you all again for joining us in the neighborhood today. And also, everything you do, as I just said, as independent publishers, so important, the lifeblood, really, of books, of readers. You guys are doing it. You're persisting, even in difficult times like during the pandemic. So my hat's off to you, and thanks for joining me, and thanks for everything that you do. Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to our guest today, Dan Armstrong, publisher at Eugene's Mud City Press, Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, founders of Portland's Pumpjack Press, and Bobby Eversman, editor-in-chief at Deep Overstock, a book publisher and literary journal also based in Portland. If you'd like to learn more about these publishers and maybe buy a few of their books, Dan's online at mudcitypress.com, Kathleen and Clark are at pumpjackpress.com, and you can find Bobby at deepoverstock.com. Just a note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, February 26th at 11 a.m. Hope to see you all again then. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope it's a beautiful day in your neighborhood. 2021 is already off to a pretty good start.